I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour wrote a very interesting piece, and we're already getting a lot of response to it. Gluten-free foods have swept across America. Millions of consumers convinced that a diet devoid of gluten, a protein found in wheat, barley, and rye, is the cure-all for everything from dementia and schizophrenia to diabetes and obesity. Sophie Egan is with us, and Sophie is the author of that article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal. She is the director of programs and culinary nutrition for the Strategic Initiatives Group at the Culinary Institute of America. She's the author of Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. Ever since living in Italy, she has been fascinated by food and custom, and we'll be welcoming phone calls just from an indication of how much interest there is on this on Facebook. We're going to get a lot of calls on this issue, so let me give you our phone number and feel free to join us whenever you would like. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hi, Sophie. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
I was going to say $1 billion. The gluten-free food industry, $15 billion by the end of this year. Lordy, that's high.
Oh, yes. This is an entirely new segment of the grocery store that I think many of us have observed did not used to be there. And it has absolutely exploded.
It sure has. And the headline of your article is interesting because it's found its way into products that wouldn't have gluten in them anyhow. Gluten-free water. Scotty Myers, our producer, saw paper towels. Gluten-free paper towels. Are you kidding me?
Oh, the gluten-free paper towels. That was a new one for me, I have to say. Yeah, that example along with the water really speaks to the amount of confusion that has happened and sort of the sense that marketers have really kind of taken advantage of this in some bizarre ways. It reflects, as I argue in the Wall Street Journal piece, it really reflects a deeper lack of understanding of really a lack of food literacy, you know, understanding what is gluten. Many people have seen the Jimmy Kimmel videos, these man on the street videos where they asked people, you know, why were they were avoiding gluten and over and over, people would say, oh, well, of course I'm on a gluten-free diet, but not one of them could actually say what it was.
Right.
And that's what's happening with these products where there would never be gluten in the first place, but, oh, that's a value add now, the fact that it's missing.
Yeah. Well, and it is a serious issue, but for a very few people in this country, 1% of Americans have celiac, and obviously you have to be extraordinarily careful about gluten-free products if you have that disease.
Absolutely. And this is really the crux of the issue is that there is, you know, as you mentioned, about 1% of the population for whom this is a very serious medical condition. It's an autoimmune response, can cause serious damage to the intestine. And for that subset of the population, they definitely need to be on the lookout. There is a newer sort of gray area that's being called gluten sensitive. This population of people, about 6%, where they're, you know, non-celiac gluten sensitivity, and the range of symptoms there is wider. And it's this is an area that's not that well understood yet. And then the rest of us have no reason to be gluten-free. However, fully a third of Americans are avoiding gluten. And to me, the problem here is really with those numbers, where you sort of hear word of mouth, you know, that a friend tried it, or maybe you self-diagnosed.
Right.
And all of a sudden, people are going on gluten-free diets when, in reality, there's a lot of problems with going on a gluten-free diet. And actually, interestingly, the Celiac Disease Foundation website cautions against this. It says, don't switch to gluten-free, don't jump on that bandwagon unless you have been diagnosed by a doctor, because of the wave of people who are completely altering their diets without knowing whether they really have the need to.
So
there are a variety of problems. Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Yeah, so some of the main problems with going gluten-free when you don't need to are that often we overlook what's being replaced. in these reformulated processed foods, which is usually when you strip out the gluten, you know, the primary purpose it serves is as you know, elasticity and kind of a filler. So junk fillers like tapioca starch and potato flour and all these other additives are being brought in, along with lots of sugar to make up for the gluten being removed. And those are no better for us. In some cases, they're actually worse. And another great example of how it's worse is that people are skipping whole grains altogether, for which there is tons of evidence of the health benefits. And it's sort of this sense of like, well, better safe than sorry, better, you know, skip the whole section of grains, whereas not all grains have gluten, and the nuances can be missed, along with all the fiber and other nutritional attributes of consuming whole grains. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, it can be really misleading. There's sort of this misappropriation of gluten-free for weight loss purposes when, as mentioned, those who really need to be avoiding gluten, it's for, you know, much more serious medical conditions, not to lose weight, for which there is not actually evidence that gluten-free eating will lead to those results.
It seems like every 2 years, or maybe even more frequently, usually a doctor writes a book about some kind of fad, and it catches on, and all of a sudden, all kinds of people are following this particular diet. You mention in your article in the Wall Street Journal that there were two best-selling books a couple years ago, Wheat Belly and Grain Brain. Are those the reasons that we have this gluten-free phenomena right now?
Well, they certainly helped spread this movement, I would say. I think that many of us in the kind of food and nutrition community look to those as the early signs. However, it's really this fad, and I hope I can use the term fad, has lasted much longer than anyone really expected. So those books actually go back into, I believe, 2011, and certainly set many other writers and others have kind of helped to fuel the fire. The real issue that I see, as you said, is that this seems to happen over and over.
It does, really.
It reflects a much larger pattern in American food culture that I describe in my book, Devoured, which is this desire to demonize food, ingredients and nutrients. We're constantly looking for that next villain, because it's much easier psychologically to just have the good and the bad buckets and to load up on the good and to avoid the bad at all costs. And we have these nutritional darlings and demons du jour. You know, we've seen this with fat-free. We've seen it with, you know, now, of course, there are many other products or ingredients, whether it's GMOs or antibiotics and so on, sugar certainly. And some of these, absolutely, there's a lot of reason to be avoiding them. But it's that tendency to sort of go to the extremes, go, you know, into the black and white with this selling absence, as I describe in the book, of really valuing a food for what it lacks. And as soon as you see that label, you know, that it has omitted the bad thing, mm-hmm. it's like a mental sign to plow forward.
Right. What exactly is gluten, Sophie?
So gluten is a protein that's found in wheat, barley, rye, and a lesser-known item called triticale, which is kind of a cross between rye and barley. And its purpose, really, it's essentially for elasticity, and sometimes it can be found not just in breads, but in, like, salad dressings and sauces, again, for that kind of thickening property.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll start taking them right now because we have all four lines going, and I thought they would be on this topic. Sophie Egan is our guest. We're talking about gluten and this gluten-free phase. She would call it a fad and has called it a fad that has taken over the country, that about one-third of us now are in the market for gluten-free products, and yet only 1% of us have a serious disease, celiac, in which we can have problems develop in the body if we eat foods that have gluten in them. So what's going on? That's the question of the hour. 800-486-8655 is our number. We're starting our calls for you, Sophie, with Jeff in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I don't know if I have much to offer here except a couple of comments and maybe, I hope, a laugh. You were talking about bread that it was made. I just caught the end of the conversation there because I was on the line with your assistant, but it had to do with bread made out of things like tapioca starch. And I tried a loaf of health food bread made from tapioca starch and these other things and absolutely gluten-free, and I have to tell you, I don't know how healthy it was, but it was about as appetizing as plaster. Couldn't even make good toast out of the stuff.
Why'd you buy it, Jeff?
Out of curiosity.
I see.
And I remember years ago when I was a kid, some bakeries used to make a product called gluten bread, which had extra gluten in it, and that was supposed to be a health nut product back in those days. Do you remember that?
Yes.
There was an episode. Here's where the laugh comes in, I hope.
Okay.
There was an episode of The Honeymooners, a rerun that I was watching not long ago, and it had Alice and Trixie making up their shopping lists to go grocery shopping together, and Alice is making up the list, and she's going, you know, tomatoes, bananas, a loaf of glutton bread, and Trixie says, "Don't you mean gluten bread?" And Alice says, "You ever seen Ralph eat?" She just nods her head. She says, "Glutton bread."
That was a laugh, Jeff.
Have a good
All right, yeah, thanks. Thanks.
Double entendre.
Thanks very much. Carol sends this email. For people who are very allergic to gluten, it's important to find non-food items without gluten. As a teacher, Carol says, I have students who need to use gluten-free markers, so gluten-free paper towels may be not so strange.
Yeah, so this is a big topic also with the severity, the concern that there's sort of trace elements that are cross-contaminated or maybe found. You know, often you'll sort of see, like, if it's processing facilities, things like that. And I hadn't heard of markers, but I do know that certainly with some household products and other things like that, there is concern at that allergy level. But again, it just goes to the larger point that there really shouldn't be the size of the market for whatever product you're picking, given the percentage of people who actually need to be concerned about it.
Jeff, thanks for your call. Let's go to Roberta in Madison next. Hi, Roberta.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The short story is I became aware of bleached flour because I was having trouble whenever I would go out to dinner and maybe dinner rolls would be served and they'd be, you know, white dinner rolls.
Sure.
I mean, I wouldn't even be halfway through my meal and I'd be in the bathroom. And so I became aware of the bleached flour. And as soon as this was like 35 years ago now, I stopped eating anything that was made with or that I was aware that was made with bleached flour. And ever since then, I mean, so that means pizza dough, you know, dinner rolls, pasta, that kind of thing. And a friend of mine kept saying, "Oh, no, no, it's gluten." And I said, "No, it isn't gluten, because I eat breads and things like that, but I just don't eat them if they've been made with bleached flour." So I never understood why that makes a difference. But, you know,
but it does for you. And you in the article talk about making a distinction between whole grains and highly processed or refined grains. Does that include, Sophie, bleached flour?
Absolutely, yes. So this is a really important part of the discussion that to me has been kind of overlooked, which is that there's sort of this avoid wheat and grain at all costs. But the vast majority of grains that people are consuming are ultra refined, this bleached, we've all seen it, that, you know, it's practically powdered sugar in terms of consistency. And that is a result of industrial scale roller milling. And this is how most breads have been made. You know, it strips out the most healthful parts of a grain of that kernel,
yes,
which are the germ and the bran. Those are the nutritional powerhouse. But they also make it harder to process. So they kind of muck up the machinery. And those have been stripped out and removed. And then often what would happen is they then would add back in some kind of, you know, vitamins and so on for fortified flours so they could sort of sell them on those aspects. However, the intact grain was now lost. And a lot of people have this issue, I think, where because it's essentially, it's a huge sugar spike. It does not make your stomach feel great to eat something like that. It's not quite as bad as soda in terms of the experience from a glycemic level, a metabolic level, but it's very similar. And I certainly relate to what the caller is describing. And I think now that's why there's sort of this burgeoning movement to kind of reclaim a positive reputation, if you will, for bread. And these millers and bakers are actually working together around the country to return to stone milling. And actually a lot of bakeries now will mill in-house.
Huh.
And it keeps the grain and the germ intact from from those wheat kernels. And so you're getting a type of bread that people are astounded how much better they feel after they eat it. And the conversation is not about gluten. It's about the refined grain versus the whole grain. And to me, that's where more of the conversation should be heading.
Sophie Egan is our guest, Director of Programs and Culinary Nutrition for the Strategic Initiatives Group at the Culinary Institute of America, author of Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. She's author of a piece in the Wall Street Journal that caught our attention, Gluten-Free Water, A Fad Without a Grain of Sense. We'll take more phone calls in a minute. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. We're talking about the gluten-free craze this hour. Lynn in Eau Claire is next. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show. As I understand it, with the gluten thing, with our grains, they're highly processed, which destroys mostly everything but the gluten. And we hear like our loaves nice and light and white and fluffy, and you're not going to get that with a whole grain product. The gluten, working the gluten, that's the kneading, that's what produces our high white, very fastly, they're quickly raised too. And then when you do a slow raise, there's an amylase, a sugar, which is destroyed, which will also minimize the gut distress because it sits in there and ferments. But I have a story, and I'm so ashamed of myself. I made a dessert.
Yeah.
It was a pound cake, and the one of a person, I knew she didn't have celiac. I knew it as a fact. So I told, it was a liquored up trifle. I told her the liquor would destroy the amylase. Everyone enjoyed. No one had any distress. So, I mean, it's just, we're told by Madison Avenue that, you know, gluten is bad, stay away from it. And if we would use a little common sense, we could enjoy what we put in our mouths.
Thanks, Lynn, for the call. Why are we so gullible when it comes to all of this? And is it a peculiarly American gullibility?
How much time do you have? No.
We got a while.
Well, it is particularly American in the, I call this in the book, I describe this as sort of the two sides of the coin of our open-mindedness. So in the U.S., we really value progress and innovation. And so instead of many cultures, they look to tradition. They pass down recipes or they pass down ways of eating from one generation to the next. And it's very much a smaller subset or a smaller set of things that are traditionally eaten within a culture. We have an enormous range of foods that can be considered a sort of part of a regular American eating pattern. However, we part of that is that we look to new crazy foods, new diets. We very much have an unstable food culture. So this leads to, you know, new headline says that fat is good, fat is bad, and so we look to these studies and think that they can completely remove all the former advice that applied, just with a single study, when in reality, the advice about what is healthy has been pretty much the same for a while. You know, it's everything in moderation, fruits and vegetables and whole grains and, you know, other things in limited amounts that maybe aren't as good for us. But we have this sort of a deference to science and to the idea that, you know, we can always take foods and improve upon them. I always think about, for example, something like fruit leathers and fruit snacks and fruit little, you know, how many forms of dried fruit do you see in the grocery store? You know, it's not enough to just eat an apple when there's 50 different ways that you can turn it into a portable snack. That's sort of very ingrained on a very subconscious level in the American food psyche, which is that innovation and progress. So this leads us to kind of, as I said, be very susceptible to marketing in ways that other cultures maybe would have, as the caller mentioned, a little bit more kind of common sense. We would rely more on our intuition and trust ourselves more. I think that's, to me, a big problem is how little we trust our knowledge. It's sort of, many people just feel at a loss. It's like, well, I thought I was supposed to eat that, but now this new story says this, so I guess I was wrong. And I think it's time, my hope, and I really hope with reading my book Devoured, that people will really start to gain more confidence in their understanding and be less gullible, because this plays out in all kinds of bizarre ways, not just with things like fad diets, but with, as I describe in my book, stunt foods. These are these over-the-top, crazy concoctions that get pumped out from fast food chains on a nearly weekly basis. Just last week we saw Mac and Cheetos. I don't know if you saw this, Kathy.
No, I didn't.
Burger King. This is a deep-fried macaroni and cheese stuffed Cheeto snack. Doritos Locos Tacos was a cross between a Dorito and a taco that was one of the best-selling fast food items of all time. We came out in 2012 from Taco Bell, and we collectively ate 100 million in just 10 weeks. And that broke all kinds of records. So what I'm saying is that this open-mindedness can lead us to, again, jump on fad diet bandwagons, but also to buy novel food concoctions that are, whether they're coming into the grocery store or at fast food chains. And it can leave us feeling, you know, pretty confused overall, eating some bizarre things. And thankfully, though, there is a silver lining, as I describe in my book, which is that we also are really open to trying cuisines from all over the globe. So at the very least, you know, we shouldn't feel, I don't want us to all sort of hang our heads and think that our food culture is, you know, needs an entire makeover, because there are some great things about that open-mindedness, that instability. And one of them is things like food trucks or, you know, mashup foods from different cuisines like Korean tacos or non-pizza. So we've got some work to do in terms of stabilizing and giving ourselves a little bit more peace of mind. But at least along with that comes some great culinary experiences as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Jane in Stevens Point. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I have had celiac disease. I found out about 2 years ago. I'm a registered nurse, and so working with my patients, I always felt it was real important to educate them on diet compliance, you know, the diabetics and hypertension. Didn't see much celiac, though. And, I do want to say that I'm happy that the gluten-free fad is out there in some ways, because in the 2 years since I've known I've had celiac, the variety of food items and snacks and things has greatly increased, and also recipes and recipe books. The only bad thing is the cost is pretty high for a lot of those things. And even if you make your own foods, like you were talking about how healthy they are, you still, a lot of the recipes call for butter and, you know, a lot of things that aren't that healthy for you. So a gluten-free diet, like you said, isn't necessarily a healthy thing to be on.
So, Jane, when you're buying gluten-free products, do you check the labels very carefully to make sure there's not tapioca filling and sugar and all of that?
I don't so much with sugar, and I've always kind of gone low salt and, you know, maintain a good weight and all those kind of things. But I do watch labels. I always read labels. And because there are some things like a maltodextrin or soy sauce, some of those things you can't have that sneak into things.
Right. Yeah, there are a lot of things that sneak into things. That's true. And Sophie, this is a case where somebody has the disease and feels better and is following what she has to, but it's costing her some money.
Yes, and the caller makes a couple of really terrific points. One is definitely the cost, and where this becomes an additional problem is when, again, as I mentioned, where people are spending that extra money thinking they're going to get some result for instance, weight loss, which again has just been this kind of misappropriation of the movement. And really they aren't going to achieve those outcomes. And yet they're spending all this money on it. So it's sort of just another in a line of the weight loss, of kind of some fraud that happens in weight loss products. But the bigger and more important point I think that she makes is really a really great one, that this has, I think, been really a boon for those who really do have celiac because of the greater vigilance with which food companies are monitoring it, the greater transparency, and it's, you know, I think even in restaurants is probably the place where the greatest awareness has increased. Mm-hmm. Because it used to be sort of this, you're asking for what? And now it's very much that every kitchen has, you know, they have very strict protocols in the back of the in the kitchens of restaurants, because, you know, they would treat it the same as they would a nut allergy, just in terms of that severity. But the case where this can go awry, I think, is the greater number of people, again, self-diagnosing or just sort of saying that they're gluten-free because they think it will be healthier, and that can actually cause problems for restaurants or that can cause problems for celiac diners because it can make a restaurant feel like, oh gosh, another one. You know, how are we going to keep up with all these special orders? When in reality, someone like the caller would really need them to stay, as vigilant as they would have been with fewer diners to take care of.
Thanks, Jane, for the call. Was this sold, and if so, by whom, as a way to lose weight to go gluten-free?
Yeah, so this has been sort of misinterpreted by many. Some of it has to do with the you know, wheat belly, and a lot of this was about inflammation and kind of how all of your digestive problems will be solved, and along with that, you know, skinnier waistlines and so on. And it's not to say that some people don't. You know, many people have improved symptoms related to digestion, but there is not any evidence, and there's been actually some academic publications that have gone to great lengths to demonstrate that going on a gluten-free diet is not associated with weight loss. So those who are making that argument, that's unsubstantiated. And one of the other points that I think has been overlooked as well is that when you go on a gluten-free diet, it really depends what that means. But for some people, just the fact that they're looking for labels more, maybe it's just that extra pause or hesitation may lead, it's sort of a placebo, or sorry, not a placebo effect, it's a misattribution of changes in how they feel to the absence of gluten. If you're eating less, you know, refined carbs and drinking less beer, and you're kind of slowing down and checking labels for health, you know, for what's in them, just that awareness, that extra intention or kind of mindfulness about what you're eating may lead you to feel better and overall be eating healthier. But it may, in some cases, be mistaken to give gluten the credit or give the absence of gluten the credit for how you're feeling.
Anne in Milwaukee. Hi.
Who?
Anne.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Sophie. Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for your program.
Sure.
I actually think there's all this research going on now and all of this brain study and gluten study, and it's resulting in a lot of misunderstanding and getting issues mixed up. We went through the organic thing, and most of us pretty well understand that chemicals to keep things organic and pesticides aren't good for humans. Then we went into the presence of gluten. And I don't know what that is. It's not a nutrient. It's an agent for processing. Then the overprocessing and grinding and whitening of rice and all these things. All Dr. Davis said in his Wheat Belly, he went over the fact that wheat has been genetically modified. Our ancestors did not eat what we call wheat. We've changed it. We've modified it so much that we are not digesting it well yet. Who knows? Then Perlmutter, in his grain brain, carried it further and said that, according to new brain research, the wheat that we're eating and the grains, those purified grains that we're eating, are not good for our brains. That's all really new, and I don't understand it much, but I know it's out there, and I know that these are separate issues. The brain issue, the digestive issue, the organics and pesticides, and the overprocessing. When there's more research, maybe, you know, 20 years from now, it'll all get sorted out. But right now, we don't understand.
Sophie.
Yes, I'm really glad that the caller brought this up, because we often, in general, research, you know, nutrition science is a relatively new field. But in particular is this emerging area of gut health, right? We've maybe heard of your microbiome, and that's the flora in your stomach, and that is leading people to not only avoid gluten but sort of go crazy on probiotics, and it's this demonstration of a tendency again where often our interest in health and wellness outpaces the collective knowledge about health and wellness. And that can feel very dissatisfying, because instead we want to act on a single study, when in reality, often the evidence that may be there is something along the lines of, you know, a small study suggests that and concludes that more research is needed to know definitively. But people will, not only consumers, but entire products will come out in response to something very sort of preliminary like that. But I think the caller, it makes the important point that it's probably going to take quite a bit of time before we really understand this, because this is a pretty new area, and in particular with relation to mental health and the connection to the foods we eat. So much of it really does remain to be seen.
And those were two books, and they became bestsellers, and people are familiar with the title of them if they haven't read the book. Have there been other scientific studies that debunk those ideas in those books, more of those than the best-selling books, or what's the status of science now?
So, you know, I certainly can't give the comprehensive status there, but I know that in particular some nutritionists and health writers have been concerned about the conclusions that are drawn in those books. So there have been studies that have, this is what I refer to in my Wall Street Journal piece, where they did actually, you know, sort of follow people on a gluten-free diet, and they have concluded definitively that there is not the weight loss connection. In terms of other associations, I think that much of it is, you know, I know, for instance, in the last just 5 years, that a ton of funding has opened up in order to encourage scientists to, not necessarily on gluten-free, but into the microbiome and into understanding our gut health, and that inevitably will connect to this. I do also know that there's a couple of books actually that have come out in response. So one of them is Gluten Exposed, The Science Behind the Hype, and that's co-authored by the director of the Celiac Disease Center, Peter Green, as well as a Barnard College professor Rory Jones. So I'm sure that that book, Gluten Exposed, dives deep into all that has happened in the wake of those earlier bestsellers.
And one wonders if it will become a bestseller or not, Sophie. Right?
Absolutely. That's how this goes.
That's how this goes. Let's go to Jennifer in La Crosse next. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
All right. I'll try to be as concise as possible. For about 10 years or so, my mom had a lot of digestive issues. And about a year and a half ago, and we are still, even to this day, very suspicious of the whole gluten movement. But about a year and a half ago, she decided to go gluten-free. And whereas almost every day for 10 years, her stomach problems and other digestive issues would be on a scale of 10, roughly 7 to 9 almost every day, now a bad day is like a number 3. When we were originally looking at this whole situation and wondering what we were going to do about it, I thought I had read something about how there are some other nutrients that people sometimes have reactions to that can also be found in foods that are high in gluten, but I cannot remember what that would be. She's never been tested for celiacs, but it's helped, but we'd like to understand why. And we're wondering if it's probably not a gluten issue, but if this other nutrient might be an issue, and it's possible that I'm remembering something incorrectly.
Jennifer, doesn't your mom go in and get tested to find out what it is that's causing this?
Well, she had talked to a doctor before, and it just didn't sound like, to the doctor wasn't really, I don't know if they weren't interested in doing it, but they opted not to.
I see.
For now, yeah. And she decided to give the diet a try regardless of testing, and it seems to have helped.
Sophie?
Yeah, sure. So, well, I'll just first full disclaimer, I'm certainly in no position to be giving dietary advice to any person. And I think in general, another big issue with the gluten-free fat is that every case is so specific to an individual. And I think what is a corollary movement right now is around personalized nutrition. And it's sort of this recognition that it's really remiss of us to even be talking about sort of, you know, is this diet a good or bad in general? And more, does this, first of all, eating pattern, which is to say a less restrictive way of eating that can be sustained over time as opposed to a very regimented diet, but do different eating patterns work better for different people? And I think there are still some general takeaways. You know, for instance, a Mediterranean eating pattern is pretty universally understood to be healthy. However, I think the growing appreciation for the personal nature of nutrition is important. That said, I think, as I mentioned, that some of this this self-diagnosis can be troublesome. However, I completely empathize because for so many people, and a lot of this, I think, with the kind of gray area of non-celiac gluten sensitivity, it's almost to replace what was for a long time called irritable bowel syndrome, you know, IBS,
right,
which was kind of this catch-all for like going to the doctor and them saying, we know you're having stomach issues. We don't know what it is. You must have IBS. And it's almost like, okay, I've been diagnosed. At least I have some peace of mind. So in some ways, I sort of feel like it's kind of evolved from that into this new, well, I'll give it a try to remove gluten. But just in terms of for the caller who might be trying to look into this, I'm guessing that the what she's referring to is FODMAPs. That's this acronym for, it's a fermentable oligosaccharide, something like that. But it's a sort of a series of carbohydrates that are also being looked into because of gastrointestinal symptoms that are associated with removing those. And now I'm not advocating by any stretch that everyone go now on a FODMAP diet. Let's just make that very clear. however, I just do know that people in these areas of research are simultaneously sort of looking into that, and I'm just guessing that that's what the caller was curious to look into more.
Yeah. It is hard to diagnose all of that. A lot of people suffer from what Jennifer's mom is suffering from, and it's just hard to get to the bottom of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. More phone calls momentarily. We're talking about the gluten-free craze this hour and why all of a sudden it's become this huge marketing thing with the industry for gluten-free food spending $15 billion by the end of this year. Gluten-free this and that, things that don't really need to be gluten-free are gluten-free. So what's going on? That's the question of the hour. And our guest has done a piece that caught our eye that's in the Wall Street Journal, and she's also the author of Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. Sophie Egan is Director of Programs and Culinary Nutrition for the Strategic Initiatives Group at the Culinary Institute of America. 800-486-8655 is our number. More phone calls from you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Donna in Hartford next. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you.
Sure.
And I would specifically like to just start out and thank Sophie for pointing out how individual eating and consumption truly is. We do just have to listen to our own bodies. We have to think about our own genetics, what might have been passed down or what we might have caused by the life that we lead and the foods that we eat. I told your screener that I was calling specifically to say that more than celiac disease can be helped by a gluten-free diet. I know this firsthand. My hairstylist several years ago was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis and, put on a specific medication, which then lowers your immune system. And she also was suffering from several sinus infections, and they kept finding that it was yeast-based. Well, eventually she read the Wheat Belly Diet book, I believe it was, and started trying those recipes and decided to go gluten-free. And I know that her pain has been reduced enormously, and I believe for a while she was even having to give herself some sort of injections, and I'm pretty sure that she's even off the drug now. So she's been able to turn her health around and continue on with her career, and she's 61 years old. So, and I just reached the grand old age of 50, and about that same time was suffering with some gut pains that were really starting to be very concerning to me. And I was working closely with my chiropractor, who uses nutritional supplements and things, professional grade. And she said, she was checking me, and she said, your gallbladder really needs some attention, and it's really being plugged by wheat. So I would highly suggest, unless you'd like to have a nice trip to the emergency room or the operating table, that you get off of that. And I can tell you that with the new professional-grade nutritional supplements that she's prescribed and by getting off of the wheat, I have turned that around for myself. And so I think you do just have to listen to your body and, do whatever it is that you feel right to do. And yeah, I would agree that weight loss isn't a positive symptom or whatever of getting off the gluten necessarily, because at first it's difficult and you might want to, eat something else instead or go run and get everything that's gluten-free on the shelf, and you really do have to read the label. So as Sophie indicated many times, mm-hmm. if it's at least teaching people something about their guts, teaching something about, digestion and making them read labels, then, really, what the heck? It's
all right. Thanks very much for your call. Sophie.
I think, as I mentioned, or as we've kind of discussed throughout this hour, these are very complicated issues, and it is different for each person, and a lot still remains to be seen. I think, not particularly interested in giving personal advice. However, at a broad level, I would just encourage people to check in with their doctor before jumping onto a certain diet, given the potential nutritional dangers of going on a gluten-free diet that are often overlooked. And I think the last thing I would just add on to that is, in general, in the U.S., sort of taking a step back, we want to, and I really hope with armed with the self-awareness that my book Devoured can provide people, I hope that we can start to shift away from just dieting in general and the idea that very strict, again, unless you have severe medical reasons to, but at a high level, we need to shift towards eating patterns that are more sustainable throughout a lifetime. Part of why some of us in the food and health community have felt that we need to sort of speak up about gluten-free is that this is a pattern that has repeated itself throughout history, throughout American history, and hopefully we can really start to shift towards a just much more whole foods-based eating pattern that has room for, you know, everything in moderation. It's that boring but timeless advice that really does remain to be sound today. And I think the other thing is, at a high level, is just how much processed food most of us are eating, regardless of which diet we're on, if we're paleo or we're gluten-free or whatever we are. We need to really realize how much marketing is being involved, how many new products are emerging in response to these things. So it's the how you do it that also really matters. And we really have to pay attention to again, these processed foods that emerge to sort of fill these new fears that inevitably creep up, whether it's from a book or a headline or a celebrity who is touting something. And I hope we can sort of be, we can kind of start to outsmart some of these trends.
And I remember some shows that we've done on supplements. You have to be careful with supplements as well in terms of honesty in the label. It's not a very regulated industry. We are very susceptible to being able to take a pill that's going to cure what ails us, and it may not even have in its pill form what it is that's supposed to ail us. We're just gullible in that regard. That's another huge industry.
Oh, Kathleen, I'm so glad you mentioned that. And that was something that did concern me in what the caller said, which was about supplements. Supplements are such an unregulated area. There's a tremendous amount of fraud, mislabeling. There are many, sort of emergency room visits that occur. And it's true. It comes from this, it's almost kind of an efficiency orientation from our kind of, pride in productivity, where we want the easiest solution, the quick fix, the magic bullet. It's a lot easier to just get your entire day's worth of vitamin C in a pill than peel an orange, when in reality an orange has all the vitamin C you would need.
I know. It tastes good too.
It's very true. It tastes much better.
Yes, yeah. It does.
And will make you feel full. It's a perfect snack. So
yeah.
That's sort of the hope in general, because it's all wrapped up together.
We have about a minute left. Bill in Kewaunee. Hi.
Hi, ladies. Great show. A quick story on me. About 10, 12 years ago, I was having a lot of distress, tried the supplements, you know, some of the ones that start with M and all that kind of stuff, and didn't help. Went to Doc. He said, I doubt if it's gluten. Very practical doctor. He said, I doubt if it's gluten, but he said it's easy to figure that out and just stop. But if you're going to stop, stop for 2 years, as much as you possibly can, and you'll be able to come back to it. Absolutely right. I could come back. I could come back to having a toast or an English muffin in the morning without, by noon, being the first guy to line to the bathroom. Fast forward to now. A year or so ago, my wife and I started taking some decent nutritional classes and coming back to the messages from before. Whole grains, whole foods, something you recognize as food.
Mm-hmm.
I feel so much better. I still eat like a pig. I mean, I'm still a guy, right?
Yeah.
I eat all kinds of stuff, and I'm losing weight like crazy. Haven't changed anything, but going more to whole grains
foods.
And foods that I can recognize.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes sense. Makes common sense and eating sense. Sophie, we're plumb out of time. And I want to thank you very much for being with us and for drawing attention to something that's kind of overtaken us and we haven't sat back and said, why?
Well, I'm really honored and thrilled to have had the opportunity and appreciate all the interest from the callers. So it's really my pleasure. And
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Sophie. Sophie Egan, our guest, talking about the gluten-free craze. The Wall Street Journal article is on our website in case you want to read it. Our Facebook page, actually, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Scotty Myers, and thanks to Carrie Salinas and KP Whaley for producing an on-air production of this program. We'll be with you again tomorrow, Early Childhood Teachers.